Hello and welcome back to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the November 22nd to November 28th edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, an illustration depicting a ball cap, a red ball cap. And although its markings can't be seen in their entirety, the cap appears to say, "Make America Great Again." The MAGA hat is upside down and filled with various things, including jewelry, a nice watch, a wrapped gift or two, and plenty of cash. The headline, "Anything Goes America." The cover leader, "Donald Trump's Presidency. Welcome to Anything Goes America," where the loosening of rules and tolerance of corruption will lead. Then, four additional leader articles, starting with geopolitics. To avoid crushing change, Europe must take control of its destiny. If it does not, China will exploit the continent's weaknesses. Then, time for a pause. Why governments should stop raising the minimum wage. After a decade of rises, there are now far better tools for fighting poverty. Then, the power and the fury. Don't let a scandal undermine the defense of Ukraine. Outrage is justified. Letting Vladimir Putin win would be disastrous. Then, the final leader article will be "The Incredible Shrinking Market. Mortgage lending in America is seizing up. How to revive it. Some rules introduced after the financial crisis have gone too far." After that, we'll move to the finance and economics section for "Gravity Wins." Crypto got everything it wanted. Now it's sinking. The slump could spread across financial markets. Then to the China section for "Practical Learning." China has too many university grads and too few jobs for them. It wants to push youngsters towards vocational colleges instead. And then finally, we'll come back to the United States section for "If Wonks Ruled," how to lower America's soaring healthcare costs. As politicians debate populist schemes, they ignore impactful changes in plain sight. So that is our lineup. Let's go back to the top for the cover leader. Donald Trump's Presidency. Welcome to Anything Goes America, where the loosening of rules and tolerance of corruption will lead. When Harry Truman left office, he had many opportunities to get rich. He turned them down. "I could never lend myself to any transaction, however respectable, that would commercialize the prestige and dignity of the office of the presidency," he said. The man who had given the order to drop two atom bombs lived on income from his memoirs and an army pension worth $1,350 a month in today's money. What a sucker. Had he been president in the 21st century, Truman could now be flying private to paid speaking engagements, soliciting donations to his foundation from foreign governments, and watching his daughter serve on company boards and his former staffers run their own lobbying shops. Presidents reflect the mores of their times. Truman's instinct to follow self-imposed rules was characteristic of 1950s America. What, then, are America's rules in 2025, when the president has accepted a Boeing 747 from one country seeking his favor and a 130,000 gold bar from another, and when his family has struck cryptocurrency partnerships with foreign governments? This is the anything goes era in America. It did not start with Donald Trump, but he has upped the tempo and removed constraints that once held others back. Skirting the rules is all right if you have political protection. Wealthy individuals may rest easy knowing that their tax returns will not be audited. The Department of Justice has dropped prosecutions of politicians for corruption. Its public integrity unit has been gutted. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, a post-Watergate piece of good government reform, has in effect been shelved. Past presidents have pardoned donors and relatives, but only on the eve of leaving office. Recipients of Mr. Trump's clemency this year include a cryptocurrency mogul jailed for money laundering and the son of someone who gave his political movement $1 million. The way the president's family members have enriched themselves in his second term would have astonished Truman, but it is small print in a $30 trillion economy. That is not true of tariffs, export controls, and mergers, where Mr. Trump's power and personality make it almost a fiduciary duty for company bosses to seek his good graces. Donors to the new White House ballroom, where the East Wing once stood, include firms whose main business is government contracting and those seeking regulatory approval for mergers. When there is one decision maker, and he often changes his mind, it is worth spending a lot to win his favor. Washington lobbyists used to focus on Congress. Now many of them ignore lawmakers and instead sell to clients the impression that they can influence the president or his political movement. All this eats away at the rule of law. Did the administration approve a merger or grant an export license because it was in the national interest? Or because the company bought the president's goodwill? When anything goes, nobody knows. It is easy for Mr. Trump's opponents to be shocked. Shocked at the discovery that people love money and power, and that when mixed together, they are intoxicating. And his supporters are right that there can be economic benefits when governments refrain from aggressively enforcing some rules. It may make it easier for companies to operate and foreigners to invest, without worrying that an overzealous bureaucrat will nail them for some petty infraction. Yet this argument can lead somewhere dismal. All advanced economies have strong laws and expectations that they will be applied impartially. There is no example of a big, mature, wealthy democracy smiling on public corruption and treating rules as arbitrary. So although the eventual costs are uncertain, it is plainly harder for an economy to thrive in the long run when the most important question for a boss is, do you know the president? The best parallels are found in some emerging markets, where big men rule by whim and companies must suck up to succeed. Or in America's past, before the rules and habits that until recently promoted clean government were set out. But the anything-goes era is different from the Gilded Age or the 1920s, both moments when a dash of political corruption went along with technological innovation and economic growth. Then politicians stole or skimmed money off contracts to buy political support. That is not how it works now. Outright theft from government appears to be rare. The president does not need to buy his party's loyalty, since the rank and file love him and Republican lawmakers fear him. There are other differences, too. In the 1920s, federal, state, and local government spending amounted to just 5% of GDP, compared with 36% now. In the Gilded Age, the presidency was even more marginal to the lives of Americans. The republic has had florid political corruption scandals before. What is new is the mix of a bossy, gargantuan state with the perception that it can be bought. Surprisingly, the president appears to pay a puny political price for his self-dealing, or the loosening of rules that accompanies it. Partisanship means that if Democrats say something is crooked, MAGA types conclude that it must be fine. The other side has enough examples of grubbiness. Think of how President Joe Biden's family took advantage of his position, or the Clinton Foundation received money from Qatar, to make what Mr. Trump is doing seem different only in degree. That is mistaken. And to assume partisanship gives unlimited permission to abuse or suspend rules is too pessimistic. good governance reforms have followed each era of excess. The Federal Corruption Practices Act after the Gilded Age, the Ethics of Government Act after Watergate. 10 years ago, a man ran for president denouncing Washington insiders and promising to drain the swamp. That is still one of the great themes in American politics, much more persuasive than warning that liberal democracy is under threat. The president has given his opponents a solid gold opportunity to use it. That was the cover leader, Donald Trump's presidency. Welcome to Anything Goes America, where the loosening of rules and tolerance of corruption will lead. We move on now to leader article number 2, geopolitics. To avoid crushing change, Europe must take control of its destiny. If it does not, China will exploit the continent's weaknesses. For decades, the European Union took quiet comfort from the belief that it held the key to the future. True, China dominated manufacturing, and America had the biggest armies. But in the realm of law and regulation, the world's superpower was in Brussels. During an era of globalization, only the EU understood the alchemy of transmuting nation-states into blocks that are greater than the sum of their parts. Today, no such comfort is to be had. China is not just dumping exports and subsidizing its companies. It is also out-competing and out-innovating big European industries, including car making. Last year, Germany's trade deficit with China stood at 66 billion euros, or $76 billion. This year, it could widen to over 85 billion euros, around 2% of GDP. Alarmingly, China is exploiting Europe's dependence, weaponizing embargoes, or the threat of them, in chips and rare earths. This comes as President Donald Trump has cast doubt on America's commitment to guarantee the security of NATO. As if that were not bad enough, Mr. Trump has also exploited Europe's lingering military dependence to impose a trade deal that Europeans hate. The EU was designed to flourish in a predictable world of rules and procedures. Today, it is caught between two snarling silverbacks asserting the law of the jungle. In talks between America and China that have big consequences for Europe's own economy, it is being treated with contempt. If Europe is not to drift into irrelevance, it urgently needs to find a new, tough-minded way of using power. So far, this ambition is provoking two very different reactions. And unfortunately, both could backfire. In Brussels and some capitals, the talk is of using trade protection and industrial policy to shore up strategic manufacturing. Some industries are indeed strategic, but the justification of national security risks everything from grain to timber being protected, which would only accelerate Europe's decline. Even when tariffs are justified, they are a tax on Europe's already overtaxed consumers, and, as duties on electric vehicles have shown, they may not succeed on their own terms. For their part, Europe's populist right parties are riding a wave of dissatisfaction with the continent's elites. Brussels, the populist leaders say, is robbing European economies of dynamism, as well as sovereignty. They believe the remedies for Europe's lethargy lie in national capitals. Yet even if no country follows Britain out of the EU, a breakdown of cooperation in Brussels would create a toxic brew of stagnation, recrimination, and fragmentation. That would lead the EU down a perilous path. In a lawless world, there is strength in numbers. What, then, should Europe do? For a start, it can still gain from being the defender of rules. Even if might is right for America and China, as they flout global norms, many smaller countries understand that they will benefit from a less uncertain world. The EU, by virtue of its huge market and its expertise, has convening power, especially in trade. It should set itself up as the champion of like-minded countries that want to forge ahead without America, which accounts for only 16% of global trade. Talks with India and the five members of Mercosur have until recently been agonizingly slow. Early talks with the CPTPP, whose members are natural EU allies, deserve a greater sense of urgency. Exporters in the German Mittelstand are already finding that growing markets like India and Brazil are compensating for the decline in Chinese demand. Europe can still be tough. Under trade rules, it can act against Chinese dumping and subsidies. It was foolish for Europe's car makers to depend on a single supplier of chips, especially after seeing the harm of Germany's reliance on Russian gas. Ursula von der Leyen, president of the Commission, has promised to act after China's rare earth restrictions, though that will take time and money. China may retaliate against firms that stockpile components with rare earths. All the more reason to diversify suppliers fast. If need be, the EU should use its, quote, anti-coercion instrument, which allows countermeasures, including curbs on exports vital to China. A second task is for European countries to make better use of the power they have by integrating their economies. The centrist parties still in office are scared that this will play into the hands of the populist right. However, inaction is a policy too. And leaders' bickering and timidity only vindicate the complaint that the ruling elites are out of ideas and that they lack the competence that is supposed to be their selling point. By failing to integrate, the EU is leaving a vast sum of money on the table. A single market that was designed for goods is failing to help economies dominated by services. Europe talks about deregulation with great gusto, but the urge to regulate is usually stronger. Governments have dithered over blueprints for boosting Europe's competitiveness, notably the report produced last year by Mario Draghi, an Italian grandee, fearful that such moves will cost them influence or upset this or that interest group. And with much work to do on integrating financial services and energy markets, politicians should resist the voguish fetish for manufacturing. Deindustrialization is not an idle concern, but factory jobs would be falling even without Chinese competition. To be most effective, these measures will require reform at home. Welfare is too expensive and bureaucracies too inefficient. Growth and competitiveness are hampered by regulation. Planning is often too vulnerable to challenge. The cost of energy is a tax on manufacturers. To many people in Brussels, all this will sound like an impossibly tall order. It is easy to say what needs doing, but hard to overcome the barriers to 27 independent countries acting in concert. That leads to Europe's last and perhaps greatest task. Awake to the threat, its leaders need to persuade their voters that change is coming one way or another. Either Europe grabs hold of its own destiny, or China and America will force crushing change upon it. The choice is Europe's. That was Leader Article Number 2. Geopolitics. To avoid crushing change, Europe must take control of its destiny. If it does not, China will exploit the continent's weaknesses. And we move on now to Leader Article Number 3. Time for a pause. Why governments should stop raising the minimum wage. After a decade of rises, there are now far better tools for fighting poverty. It is easy to see why politicians like raising the minimum wage. Short of cash yet keen to fight inequality, they have seized on a tool of redistribution that costs governments little and wins votes. In its budget on November 26th, Britain is likely to raise the minimum wage, which sits at 61% of median income, up from 48% a decade ago. Germany introduced the minimum wage only in 2015. By 2023, it had crossed 50%. And although America's federal rate of $7.25 an hour has not changed since 2009, many states and cities controlled by Democrats have raised their pay floors far higher. The average effective minimum wage is around $12 per hour. The highest is over $21. In one respect, the surging minimum wage is a triumph for economists. Having originally been skeptics, they embraced the policy around the turn of the millennium, arguing that wage floors did not eliminate jobs as they once feared, a finding that the experience of the past two decades seemed to confirm. Yet, as we report this week, just as governments are championing the consensus, scholars are getting cold feet. A growing body of research suggests that minimum wages distort economies in ways that do not immediately appear in jobs numbers. One worry is that it takes time for minimum wages to kill jobs. Evidence from a big hike into Seattle's pay floor in 2015 and 2016 suggests hiring at the bottom end of the labor market slowed by 10%, even though existing workers were typically not laid off. Another is that higher minimums degrade jobs rather than destroy them. When employers must pay more, but can still hire easily, they may cut corners elsewhere. New research finds that big increases in the minimum wage are associated with shorter or less predictable working hours, more workplace accidents, and fewer perks such as health insurance. The final risk is that early success breeds overconfidence. Moderate minimum wages can, counterintuitively, make jobs more abundant by offsetting the bargaining power of big employers, who would otherwise restrain hiring to suppress pay. But the more governments embrace big hikes, the more likely they are to eliminate jobs, just as a big enough tax rise will reduce revenue. One recent peer-reviewed estimate puts the average American minimum wage that corrects for employer market power at under $8. Beyond that, the minimum wage is a crude and wasteful tool for redistribution. Many minimum wage workers are not poor, but live with higher earners. And when firms raise prices to offset their steeper costs, it is the poor who suffer most, more so than from sales taxes, according to one paper. Politicians should beware these effects. Although raising minimum wages invariably polls well, electorates everywhere are also angry about soaring prices and a crisis of affordability. There is a danger of a doom loop in which employers' higher costs are passed on to consumers, making life still less affordable, including for the very workers governments are trying to help. Zoran Mamdani, the mayor-elect of New York, has promised to raise the minimum wage from $16.50 today to $30 by 2030. Prices would rise significantly as a result, making an already expensive place to live even dearer. There are better ways to help low earners. In-work tax credits are better targeted towards the poor, and if paid for with growth-friendly taxes, less harmful to the economy. They may lack the appeal of minimum wages, the costs of which are well hidden. But after a decade of aggressive increases, the responsible option is not to go higher still. It is to stop. That was Leader Article Number 3, Time for a Pause. Why governments should stop raising the minimum wage. After a decade of rises, there are now far better tools for fighting poverty. And we continue on now with Leader Number 4, The Power and the Fury. Don't let a scandal undermine the defense of Ukraine. Outrage is justified. Letting Vladimir Putin win would be disastrous. An intelligence officer likens it to an atomic bomb exploding in Volodymyr Zelensky's face. A scandal involving kickbacks and money laundering centered on Energoatom, a state-owned nuclear power agency, is fast becoming the worst crisis Ukraine's president has faced since Russia invaded his country almost 4 years ago. Two ministers have already been removed, one arrested. More high-level casualties seem certain. For Ukraine's Western supporters, the news is infuriating. For ordinary Ukrainians, whether fighting on the front or living under daily Russian missile and drone attacks, it is far worse. While their country is engaged in an existential struggle, bigwigs are alleged to have misappropriated huge sums, perhaps $100 million. If guilty, they have deprived their own troops of resources. Outrage is justified, but it is vital to understand what this scandal means and what it does not. First, the graft it reveals is not new. Ukraine, though far less corrupt than Vladimir Putin's Russia, has a long history of sleaze. The Western mission to encourage reform was always destined to be slow. The effort predates Mr. Zelensky and will outlast him. Second, if you squint, the scandal contains a glimmer of good news. Despite Mr. Zelensky's clumsy and quickly reversed attempt to curb their independence in July, the country's anti-corruption agencies appear able to do their job. That is precisely what Ukraine's supporters have hoped to see, and today's revelations may end up strengthening them. Third, at least for now, Mr. Zelensky himself is not directly implicated. Though all bucks stop at his desk, and one of those named is his former business partner. His position is clearly damaged. His chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, is now under pressure and may be sacrificed. Mr. Zelensky must do a much better job of fighting corruption to maintain morale at home and support abroad. And if the scandal were to render his position untenable, so be it. At the war's outset, he proved himself a hero by refusing to flee. But no leader is indispensable. Britain changed prime ministers in both world wars. America fought on to victory after the death of FDR in April 1945. Yes, the danger that this will poison support for Ukraine is real. Details emerged this week of a, quote, peace plan that would give Mr. Putin much of what he wants and severely weaken Ukraine. It is not yet clear how seriously Donald Trump's administration views this proposal. But critics of Ukraine in the West, from America's MAGA Republicans to European populists, have seized on the corruption scandal as proof that Ukraine is unworthy of support. They have long hunted for an excuse to justify throttling aid or normalizing relations with Moscow. This affair gives them a superficially plausible one. But only superficially. Viewed through a geopolitical lens, this scandal does not change anything. Ukraine is not, and never has been, a model of clean governance. That is not why the West has spent some $400 billion, and counting, to help defend it. Were Western support to falter, the only winner would be Mr. Putin. He would be closer to crushing Ukraine and turning it into an even more corrupt client state. If that were to happen, the eventual cost to Europe and to America, should it continue to honor its NATO commitments, would be vastly higher than the cost of continuing to support Ukraine. A victory for the Kremlin there could mean a nation of over 30 million in its thrall on the EU's doorstep, awash with weapons and bitterness. Mr. Putin might turn his attention towards NATO or Moldova. There could be huge refugee flows. Supporting Ukraine is not an act of selfless principle, but an exercise in hard-headed realism. The defense of Ukraine is the defense of Europe. If the profiteers are guilty, they deserve to rot in prison. But the West must not let a nasty scandal blind it to the greater danger that looms from Moscow. That was Leader Article Number 4, The Power and the Fury. Don't let a scandal undermine the defense of Ukraine. Outrage is justified. Letting Vladimir Putin win would be disastrous. And this is a good time to pause and remind you that you're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, this program featuring articles from the November 22nd to November 28th edition of the magazine. And we turn now to the final leader section article, leader number 5, The Incredible Shrinking Market. Mortgage lending in America is seizing up. How to revive it? Some rules introduced after the financial crisis have gone too far. The American mortgage market is shrinking. After years of rising house prices and dwindling lending, the value of mortgage debt as a share of the housing stock is at its lowest in 60 years. To those who remember the global financial crisis, when troubled housing loans blew up the banks, this may sound like good news. In fact, it is cause for concern. Many families are being needlessly locked out of home ownership. Labor mobility has slowed as homeowners stay put. And because modest single-family homes have fewer prospective buyers, fewer of those properties are being built. America's mortgage market needs unclogging. The surging interest rates of recent years are partly to blame. During the pandemic, homeowners rushed to refinance at record low interest rates. Now that rates are higher, the 30-year mortgage rate stands at 6.2%, compared with 2.7% in early 2021, they are loath to move. The Federal Housing Finance Agency, or FHFA, has found that the lock-in caused by higher rates cut house sales by 1.7 million between mid-2022 and mid-2024. That is not the whole story. Mortgage activity was depressed long before rates began to rise because of post-crisis regulation, especially for smaller loans and borrowers with average or below-average credit scores. Mortgage lending to those with credit scores of 760 or higher, above the average of 705, now accounts for 2/3 of the total, more than twice the prevailing share of just over 2 decades ago. In response to the drought, the Trump administration has floated various ideas. One of them is a sideshow. The president and Bill Pulte, the head of the FHFA, have both enthused about a 50-year mortgage. But ultra-long loans would leave homebuyers paying off mortgages into retirement and would worsen the lock-in effect when interest rates rise, gumming up the housing market further. Mr. Pulte also says the administration is studying portable mortgages, which are a better idea. Portable loans, which are common in countries including Britain and Canada, allow homeowners to take their mortgages with them when they move house. It could help ease the part of the problem caused by high interest rates and boost mobility again. More is needed to revive the market. After the financial crisis, lenders' fees were capped, and standards for assessing a borrower's ability to repay were tightened to the point that issuing loans would often be unprofitable. Many borrowers with less regular forms of income, such as freelance workers, are now locked out of the market. Even credit unions, hardly the ravenous capitalists of Wall Street, are calling for rules to be changed for loans below $100,000. Which are now all but impossible to make. At the same time, owner-friendly rules at the federal and state level mean that it now takes a lender 608 days to foreclose on a home, up from less than 200 in 2007. In some states, such as New York, the average repossession takes over 5 years. Built-in waiting periods, lengthy court proceedings, and mandated mediation have all helped struggling homeowners to hang on to their properties for longer. But if lenders cannot repossess homes, they will treat mortgage debt as if it is unsecured, shutting many potential borrowers out of the market. Ordinary borrowers with middling credit did little to cause the crash of 2007 to 2009. But the rules introduced in its aftermath are punishing them without making the financial system any safer. As the mortgage market shrinks even further, now is the time to correct past mistakes. That was Leader Article number 5, the final Leader article in this issue, The Incredible Shrinking Market. Mortgage lending in America is seizing up. How to revive it? Some rules introduced after the financial crisis have gone too far. And we move now to the finance and economics section for Gravity Wins. Crypto got everything it wanted. Now it's sinking. The slump could spread across financial markets. On January 3rd, it will have been 17 years since Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonymous founder of Bitcoin, first unveiled the cryptocurrency. The most popular digital coin has cemented itself in the global financial order faster than any other asset. In recent years, the crypto industry has gone from an object of mockery in mainstream finance and the target of outright hostility from regulators to being broadly accepted, even encouraged. Banks and asset managers are launching products, and the latest cast of American regulators are crypto enthusiasts. In October, Bitcoin's market value peaked at $2.5 trillion. Odd as it may seem, these victories now pose a problem for crypto. Prices have tumbled. Bitcoin has dropped from an all-time high of around $126,000 in early October to just above $92,000. For a speculative asset, one which produces no income and relies solely on hopes for future capital gains, the absence of a fresh bullish narrative to justify further price rises is a challenge. And because wider acceptance has deepened crypto's links with other markets, the ripple effects from the dip will be felt far beyond the industry. It is hard to say anything with confidence about the future direction of an asset like Bitcoin. Many investors and financial journalists have tried and failed. But there has been a clear pattern to rallies in recent years. Every exhilarating upswing has been bound up with optimistic stories about greater acceptance. In 2020 and 2021, lockdowns and fiscal largesse were paired with the increasing provision of crypto trading by mainstream brokers. From late 2023, hopes rose that crypto exchange-traded funds would soon be launched. And indeed, the first ETF applications were approved by America's regulators in January 2024. Donald Trump's election victory in November that year gave Bitcoin another boost. Today, investors have no trouble getting their hands on Bitcoin. Brokers offer access to a range of crypto assets to anyone with a phone. Some big investors have stayed away. This month, crypto enthusiasts cheered the news that the Czech Central Bank had purchased $1 million in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. But that was a drop in the ocean relative to the bank's $171 billion in reserves. And most central banks still rule out including digital assets in their defensive hoards. The scope for higher trading volumes, then, seems limited. The other price of victory is that the pain from a crypto crash will be felt more widely than in the past. The investors most exposed to the recent slump are those who behaved as if the boom would never end. That includes Strategy, a software company that is now mainly a leveraged bet on Bitcoin, having borrowed to accumulate about $60 billion worth. The firm's market capitalization is now below the value of its Bitcoin holdings, raising the prospect of crypto fire sales. It is not the only source of risk in the digital asset universe. On October 10th, some $19 billion in leveraged crypto positions were wiped out after Mr. Trump announced fresh 100% tariffs on China. The levies were walked back a few days later. No one knows how much leverage remains, but the further prices fall, the greater risk of serial blow-ups. The biggest risk of all is that miserable sentiment in cryptocurrency spreads to other markets. Since 2020, Bitcoin has become more correlated with technology stocks. These could fall further if flighty crypto investors flee equity markets. The adoption of digital asset products by mainstream financial firms has also bound crypto to traditional markets. BlackRock, which manages $13.5 trillion of assets, is custodian of the world's largest Bitcoin ETF. One-third of the customers who bought into the fund as their first BlackRock product have gone on to invest in the firm's more classic ETFs. The European Systemic Risk Board, a financial watchdog, fears that the failure of a large crypto investment product could spill across conventional finance. The overall volumes have now reached levels that make this scenario a genuine concern, it wrote last month. Stablecoins, crypto assets designed to hold their value and facilitate payments, are another source of overlap. The size of the outstanding market has grown by almost 50% in the past year to more than $300 billion. In July, they won regulatory certainty in America when the Genius Act set out the assets their issuers could hold. But so far, most stablecoins are still used to transact in crypto rather than outside of it. That means bear markets in riskier crypto assets can drive outflows from stablecoins. Since these are mostly backed by American treasuries, a shock could shake bond markets if issuers have to fire sell assets to return cash to investors. Any stablecoin not fully backed with the safest assets may well, quote, depeg and enter a bank run-like spiral, accelerating liquidations. Crypto may have exhausted most of the obvious catalysts for a proper rebound, from the greater ease of investment to more regulatory certainty. But one piece of news could just help it soar again. Enthusiasts got less than they had hoped for from the strategic Bitcoin reserve set up by Mr. Trump in March. It has remained a vehicle for Bitcoin acquired mainly as a result of law enforcement seizures. Some legislators, including Cynthia Lummis, a Republican senator, have supported the purchase of more Bitcoin on the open market. If the price continues to fall, advocates might call it a buying opportunity. Crypto fans close to the administration, many of whom will be nursing losses, might well agree. The prospect of the government stepping in seems remote, but when it comes to both crypto and politics, surprises can never be ruled out. That was an article from the Finance and Economics section. Gravity wins. Crypto got everything it wanted. Now it's sinking. The slump could spread across financial markets. And we turn now to the China section for practical learning. China has too many university grads and too few jobs for them. It wants to push youngsters towards vocational colleges instead. On the banks of the Fuchun River in Zhejiang, an eastern province, the youngsters who will power China's future are at work. At Hangzhou Technical Institute, more than 6,000 students aged between 14 and 20 are learning how to operate drones, manufacture rare earth magnets, and maintain electric vehicles and industrial robots. Every year, Shao Weijun, its boss, asks more than 600 Chinese firms to forecast their demand for different skills. Their answers alter what courses his institute chooses to run. He says almost all his students leave with good jobs. China is in the midst of a big push for more and better practical training. Around 34 million young people are studying in China's vocational education system. These include teenagers in vocational track high schools, as well as students in post-secondary colleges that operate in parallel to universities. Yet, as in many other countries, China's vocational classrooms suffer from being seen as a sink for unserious students. Learners and parents often see vocational institutions as underfunded and badly run. In many cases, they are correct. The Communist Party has good reasons to want to sort all this out. One is a rising suspicion that China's university sector has grown too big too fast. Many clever young graduates are struggling to find work, and around 17% of Chinese aged 16 to 24, excluding current students, were unemployed as of October. These include a lot of youngsters with impressive qualifications. Moreover, graduates are failing to secure employment, even as many company bosses complain that they are finding it difficult to hire staff with the skills they need. The party accepts that China is going to need brilliant scientists and engineers if it is to dominate the technologies of the future. But it also recognizes that it will need a big army of technicians to keep all its robots, data centers, and other bits of gleaming kit running. Ensuring a steady supply of these is essential if China is to achieve the lofty objectives of its next five-year economic plan. In 2022, China's government revised its law on vocational education, describing practical qualifications as, quote, equally important as academic ones. In December 2024, the Education Ministry announced it was creating 40 new vocational courses for learners at various levels, many relating to whizzy industries such as AI and biomedicine. And in June this year, the government launched a campaign to improve the skills of 30 million more workers by 2027, particularly those, quote, urgently needed for industrial development, in fields such as deep-sea technology and the so-called low-altitude economy, drones, flying taxis, and the like. This latest campaign will notably include efforts to send some university graduates back to college, in the hope that they will emerge with more marketable skills. Provincial governments in Zhejiang, Shandong, and Anhui, and others, have laid out plans to help China reach its target for 2027. These include retraining programs for people already with degrees. Students in vocational institutions have long sought to trade up to spots in academic ones, so it is remarkable that traffic is now beginning to flow in the other direction. Though the vocational to university path has long been popular as a potential track for vocational college students to apply to start a university's bachelor's degree, some new programs allow university graduates to pursue technical training in a reverse trend. A survey by Xiaopin, a recruitment agency, last year found that 52% of university graduates think additional technical training would increase their employment opportunities. The government has coupled all this with a big propaganda push to convince more people that practical training may make their fortunes. Once upon a time, the notion that white-collar workers are superior to blue-collar workers was deeply ingrained, noted The People's Daily, a party mouthpiece, in July. But now, as higher education becomes universal, the strong correlation between academic qualifications and employment is breaking down. In August, China Youth Daily, a state-owned newspaper, quoted an education ministry researcher calling for a rethink of values that have resulted in, quote, an oversupply of diplomas and a shortage of skills. A long-term goal for China, as for many other countries, is to lower barriers that keep academic and vocational pathways firmly distinct. Doing this would make it easier for learners to move from one track to the other, or indeed to acquire qualifications that blend elements of both. Chinese officials have increasingly encouraged the creation of application-oriented bachelor's degrees at lower-tier universities, says Gerard Postiglione, an emeritus professor of education at the University of Hong Kong. And more colleges that were once purely vocational are now being allowed to offer some bachelor's degrees. Are attitudes on the ground shifting? It depends who you ask. Shen Kecheng is a first-year student of electrical automation at Beijing Polytechnic University. His course is vocational and includes lots of hands-on learning, which he likes. He reckons his job prospects in the aviation sector are good. Nevertheless, he plans to stay in education until he has managed to layer a bachelor's degree on top of it. After all, companies continue to give university graduates priority when hiring, he says. Hei Li, a 22-year-old studying in the Xiang Railway Vocational and Technical Institute, seems more certain of his choice. He says that when his cousin got into a master's program at a good university in Sichuan province, his family threw a party. But after graduating, she ended up with a short-term job in a primary school, he says. Not at all the payoff she had imagined. His college is far less prestigious, but it has tight relationships with employers across the country. A good job maintaining subway systems is on the cards. It's impossible for everyone to be in management or sit in an office, he says. It's about adapting to the times. That was an article from the China section, Practical Learning. China has too many university grads and too few jobs for them. It wants to push youngsters towards vocational colleges instead. And we turn now to the United States section for If Walks Ruled, How to Lower America's Soaring Healthcare Costs. As politicians debate populist schemes, they ignore impactful changes in plain sight. Healthcare debates, particularly about subsidies for insurance coverage, were one reason for the government shutdown. But since it ended on November 12th, the debates have not quieted. Donald Trump proposed a new cash-in-your-pocket health policy, writing on his social media site that rather than subsidizing, quote, big, fat, rich insurance companies, the government should be, quote, sending the money directly back to the people. Republicans in Congress are rushing to flesh out this idea, which risks upending the insurance market. Before they do that, they might consider some smaller-scale reforms to curb healthcare spending growth, which exceeds the rate of inflation. The savings could be impactful, and there are three places to start. The first would be to even out how much Medicare, the government insurance plan for the elderly, pays doctors for procedures. Currently, if a patient has a procedure at an outpatient facility, the hospital gets more than if the same treatment took place at a doctor's office. This was originally intended to help with running costs, but has since grown to be a wasteful cash cow. The Congressional Budget Office, a nonpartisan scorekeeper, has previously estimated that equalizing payments by location could save anywhere from $5 billion to $156 billion over 10 years, depending on what was covered. In comparison, keeping the expanded Affordable Care Act subsidies, as Democrats would like to do, would cost $350 billion over the next decade. A second area ripe for reform is Medicare Advantage, privately provided Medicare plans. These plans have been growing in popularity. More than half of Medicare beneficiaries now use them, compared with a quarter in 2010. They often provide appealing vision, hearing, and dental benefits, but they end up costing the government more, despite typically having healthier enrollees. Insurers get higher payments when people are sicker, which pushes plans to make people appear sicker than they really are. Covering someone under Medicare Advantage costs 20% more than covering the same person under traditional Medicare, which resulted in $84 billion in additional government spending in 2025. Reforms could make it harder to present patients as sicker. A third opportunity involves pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs, middlemen between chemists and drug makers. They are supposed to help wrangle discounts for insurance plans and steer people towards cheaper medicines. But PBM's opaque pricing and business model has led critics to argue that they are keeping too much of the discounts for themselves. Nearly two dozen bills were introduced in the last Congress, trying to change various aspects of PBMs. By increasing transparency, policymakers hope employers would be able to wrestle better prices out of PBMs. This is the reform most likely to happen. A transparency rule almost became law in 2024. The other changes are less likely because hospitals will resist more revenue reductions in the aftermath of Mr. Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, which includes swaths of health spending cuts. Touching Medicare Advantage comes with the additional political risks of messing with a popular bedrock program about which older voters are passionate. That was an article from the United States section, edited slightly for length, full disclosure. If Wonks Ruled, How to Lower America's Soaring Healthcare Costs. As politicians debate populist schemes, they ignore impactful changes in plain sight. And that brings us to the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the November 22nd to November 28th edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veach, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And as always, I remind you that if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other SunSounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on demand.